Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Challenger Cities podcast with me, Ian Montgomery. And I'm really excited about this episode because I had another Brit on. So I have Thomas Abel, and he's really interesting, partly because his social media posts are fantastic, but also because he brings a perspective in terms of transportation across different kinds of organisation. I think is really, really important. So he's worked in commercial enterprises that have a very customer-centric mindset, so Chiltern Railways, and we'll talk about that. He's done startups. He calls it Uber for Coaches. I think he doesn't like calling it Uber for Coaches, but he's been in that VC-backed startup mindset in the realm of transportation, then been in National Express, a big story transportation organization, and then more recently, Transport for London, so public sector. It's a very different culture environment. He now runs a business called Freewheeling, hence he posts a lot of great stuff on social media around innovation, culture, actually how do you do things in transportation and what should we care about. So the conversation will be wide-ranging. We'll talk about how London has developed over many, many years in terms of being this world-class transportation city, as well as what London has done wrong and had to relearn. We'll talk about the connection to housing. We'll talk about where is doing transportation really well and some of the things that we can learn to do it better, to make better Challenger Cities. So I really enjoyed this conversation. We could have gone on longer, it was long enough. But I hope you really enjoy it too. So here is a conversation with Thomas Abel. Thomas, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with me, and like one of the first non-Canadians to do this podcast. As we've
quite intimidated by that.
Maybe you should be, especially you haven't even been here. So we need to get you over to Canada as well at some point. But this might be the audition tape, if you will.
No, I have never been to Canada. The nearest I've been is Poughkeepsie, which isn't that far, but it isn't really that near either.
It's not a million miles away. And if Donald Trump has his way, that will be a neighbouring bit of one great, huge nation in the not too distant future. That's a good way of catching up for Canadians to start with. Anyway. The reason I wanted to talk to you was you're probably one of the best people who talk about transit at the moment. And you have the benefit that you've actually spent a lot of time working in transportation, doing your own startup, working in big transportation organizations at TfL. But rather than me bastardizing your intro, let's get going with you just sharing a little bit about you, your background, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, as you said, I've had a comparatively unusual career through transport in the sense I've kind of done every way you can look at this particular sector. I've done private sector, public sector, corporate, startup, highly entrepreneurial, highly traditional. So I started at National Express, which at the time was UK's largest coach, rail and bus operator, still the largest coach operator, no longer runs any trains at all, but it ran 9 rail franchises at the time. And I was there for 7 years. Then I joined Chiltern Railways. Now, I imagine if you're Canadian, you've never heard of Chiltern Railways. So let me just tell you, when the rail network in the UK was privatised back in the 1990s, 25 train companies were created, of which 24 were immediately sold to existing bus corporates and became highly traditional corporate entities. Chiltern Railways was the exception. It was a management buyout, private equity back, and it was highly entrepreneurial. The guy who bought it, Adrian Shooter, is a bit like one of those kind of traditional Victorian railway entrepreneurs. He was a bit of a lunatic. He was a nightmare to work for, but he created this extraordinarily entrepreneurial rail operator. I joined in 2009. I left in 2016, so I was there for 7 years, during which time we doubled revenue from 100 million to 200 million, which is, you know, it's not easy doubling revenue in an established rail business, and there's all kinds of reasons why we achieved that. Then I founded a startup, which is a two-sided marketplace called Snap, which was... Everyone always said at the time when I was going around VCs raising money, they'd say, this is Uber for coaches, isn't it? Which is, you know, the obvious answer is to say yes, because, you know, VCs like, you know, X for Y. And I always said no, because I hated Travis Kalanick's toxic corporate cultures. It was that era. And obviously it would have been much better to say yes, especially as yes was actually the correct answer. And then in 2021, I joined Transport for London as Director of Strategy and Innovation. And I was doing that until this last summer. And I now run my own consulting business called Freewheeling, which does transport and innovation.
Excellent. So something I want to get to is, when a lot of the time when places are thinking about transportation, they think about transportation almost in isolation. And actually transport has a huge thing to do with housing. You gave a talk recently in Berlin, which you kindly shared with me, And I thought you tied it really, really nicely to what London did incredibly well as a megacity for transport almost 100 years ago now. And then it forgot about it, and now it's relearning it, and it's still having to learn as the world's moved on. How do you feel about cities when it comes to understanding what transportation really means, and not seeing it as this thing that is isolated as a department? And often in the North American case, it's the thing that's the last resort for people who can't afford a car.
It's really interesting because London did learn these lessons very early on. And there was a sort of symbiotic relationship in many ways between North America and London at that point, or which was partially forgotten in London and entirely forgotten in America. But London was the world's first megacity. It was the biggest city in the world up until the Second World War. It was, with its kind of suburban hinterland, city of about 10 million people in the Victorian era. The city itself was a city of about 6, 7, 8 million at various times. I mean, you're huge by 19th century standards. And it had massive mobility challenges. And it was public transport that solved this through working out, actually, if we connect areas just outside the city with the city, then you can create new urban environments that are centered around transit stations. And Golders Green, which is in northwest London, near where I grew up, and I've seen some incredible pictures of this station built in 1907 in completely green fields. Two, three, four years later, it was part of an entirely new suburb centered around that underground station. The interesting thing, of course, is that actually this was not a city building idea. It was how London was built, but it wasn't designed as a corporate city building entity. It was designed as a commercial entity. And it was the Underground Electric Railways Group, which was founded by Charles Yerkes, who came to London. He was a bit of a wide boy. He came to London from Chicago, where he had funded tram networks. And he had this idea of creating an underground rail network in London that expanded the footprint of London out, and therefore he'd have the ability to profit from housing developments. And the civic element of that was wildly successful, and he created this incredible livable city with low enough density for people to have gardens and green space and flowers. There's a wonderful poster that I love that shows this woman lounging in this beautiful green garden surrounded by flowers with a red underground train in the background that symbolizes exactly what he was trying to create. So the civic result was fantastic. However, it was a commercial disaster for him, and he died in poverty.
I hadn't realized I knew a lot of the Metropolitan Line history was like metro land, and it was actually so like wealthy bankers could go live out in the home counties and then get into the city without having to drive a car. And it feels like we've now got to the point where a lot of those sort of types want to drive their car. It's almost like, how do we take it back to that? But it then brings us into the whole sort of, we get hung up on, is this a thing the public sector does? Is this a thing the private sector does? Is this a thing that we do in partnership? It feels really messy, but like, why do we get so twisted up about how to do these things? Because most things that we were doing 100 years ago, we sort of figured out and made it better. In the case of transport, we've made some things better. We've also regressed in some ways. How do we get to here?
One of the things that London does really well, and it does it really well, bluntly, because it's been told to. When the Greater London Authority Act was passed, creating the Greater London Authority in 2000, which is the latest iteration of city governance, a statutory requirement was placed on the Mayor of London to produce something called the London Plan. Within the London Plan, he then had to create the Mayor's Transport Strategy, and these are statutory requirements that he has to do. And would he do it if he didn't have to? Probably not. Very sensible that he's been forced to. London Plan is a spatial strategy for the development of London, and the Mayor's Transport Strategy is a transport strategy to fulfil the London Plan, that spatial strategy. And so, at the most foundational level, London and spatial and London transport are considered as one. And I really saw this very recently. A few weeks ago, I took my kids to play frisbee in Springfield Park. And Springfield Park is a space on a hill near Walthamstow, where I live in northeast London. And from it, you can see the city laid out before you, and specifically Walthamstow, where I live. Now, for anyone who knows London, Walthamstow is at the end of the Victoria Line. So there are three underground stations in Walthamstow, and they are, as the name suggests, underground. Yet, from Springfield Park, you can literally see the Victoria Line, because there's Walthamstow Central Station with a clump of tower blocks around it. There's Blackhorse Road Station with a clump of tower blocks around it. There's Tottenham Hale Station with a clump of tower blocks around it. None of those tower blocks existed when I moved into Walthamstow 17 years ago. They've all been built since, because an upgrade was made to the underground. That increased capacity. That meant that there was then space to carry more people, which meant that high density development was put into the London plan for the area around those stations, which was then largely privately funded by developers. Transport for London Land was released and station car parks. It was a brilliant articulation of how this can be done, combining strategic thinking, transport investment, and private development. And you can physically see it.
Is it like, I feel like people love talking about transport-oriented developments, and you'll get these plans that are like giant tower blocks. And it's almost like there's the plan version of it, which looks beautiful on a rendering. And then there's the real version of it, which you didn't see when you're like at an elevated place. And I love that. I think you shared that image before, but like that way of looking at it is, if you get the transport right, the housing will come. And then when you do that, all the other things bubble up around it, and you get business, you get commerce, you get leisure, you get what things there just like. But it's almost like this sort of thing of plan. There's the difference between planning it and actually doing it. And I think that's where a lot of people get sort of talking.
Well, it's something that London's been doing for over a century. And you know, if you go to another part of Walthamstow, Walthamstow Queen's Road Station, which is on the newly renamed Suffragette Line, all the overground lines got new names 2 weeks ago, and you get the Suffragette Line East, it used to stop at a place called Barking. But as of 2 years ago, it continues to a place called Barking Riverside, which is a station, quite a large overground station, again, in a completely empty bit of marshland a few years ago. And now the housing is spreading around it. The master plan exists. About a fifth of it's been built. You can, I recently was lucky enough to fly over Barking Riverside. You can look down, you can look at the plan, and you can look at what's there now. And it's exactly the same as the plan, but with bits of it not there yet. So this is the same as Golders Green. This is the same as Charles Yerkes, going back to 1907. Whereas in a lot of cities, including a lot of cities in the UK, unfortunately, it's the other way around. Housing happens first. And then afterwards, someone says, oh, is there a way of connecting this stuff? And of course, by the time you've built the housing, if you've not thought about this, the only way to connect it is, oh, well, people can drive their own cars, which is what happens.
People sort of mocked that. There was a photo of, like, I think it was in Shenzhen or Guangzhou, but it was like the subway station, line 11. They built so many of them. It was like out in a farmer's field. Everyone was like, oh, look how stupid this is. This is when people get development completely wrong. Fast forward 3 years and it was huge suburb of the city with like tens or hundreds of thousands of people living near it. And I find it sort of fascinating that we kind of do it backwards, and then we get confused as to like, why are all these people driving? Why do we struggle to sustain certain bars, shops, restaurants, etc.? Because you can't get the people to them. And it feels just so damp. I don't know. There's times when it's like, you feel the logical of how you can overcome it, but then how do you overcome it, I guess, is the really complicated one.
I had a great chat on my podcast with Daniel Knowles recently, the author of Carmageddon, who's from your neck of the woods. He's like you, he's a Brit, but he lives in Chicago, so not that far away from you. And he made the point, which is absolutely right and obvious, but no one will remember it, that in cities all around the world, the most expensive parts of the city are high density near public transport. That's where people want to live. And yet what we keep building for them is low density away from public transport. And obviously that's what then people buy, because that's what has been built. But it's built because it's easy and cheap to buy. So that's why you then need something like the London Plan that says, okay, this is the framework. This is what we are going to build around here. And we're going to make sure that the public transport exists, and then we're going to build around it.
I think you get this like weird pushback as well in transport where, especially on this side of the Atlantic, a lot of people look at transportation as something that is like a base level service. So like the bus might go every hour, and it might be on a bone-shaking vehicle, or the train service has like uncomfortable seats or whatever. It always feels like we tick the box at the lowest level of functionality. The thing that I really like about the certain operators that get this right, and it's good when you talk about your intro to working for Chiltern Trains, I spend a lot of time going from Haddon and Thame Park way into London because my wife's family live a few minutes walk from the station.
Fantastic. One of my customers.
But they, like, the thing with Chilton was they didn't just go, here's the base assumption of what train is as a bus operator or as somebody who worked for British Rail since the 70s. The seats were a little bit more comfortable. The frequency was always felt like a little bit ahead of the curve, so it built up the demand. I think it was the first train operator to have onboard free Wi-Fi. Building those things in so it actually felt like a consumer product versus a sort of public service advanced resort. When you get people understanding how good transportation can be, then those people that typically would have been the naysayer, then they get behind it, and then you sort of see this impact that people really want to live near that station. People really want to use that service, and it expands and it grows. I feel like we have to get back to that sort of designing these services as something that's a desirable consumer product.
I'm very glad you noticed that we were the first to do free Wi-Fi, because that was something I specifically specified it when I was at Chiltern Railways and we introduced that on my watch. So I'm glad about that. But it's exactly that. The goal was to get people using the train, not using the car. That's a consumer choice. So if you're trying to change people's consumer behavior, you've got to offer them a better product. Right. What's a better product than driving? What's an environment in which you can work? So what does that mean? Well, you need to have plug points. You need to have really good Wi-Fi. You need to have, and if you remember that the tables had little sliding out bits to make it more comfortable, and you get the laptop at the right angle so you can work well. As you say, the capacity, this happened before my time, but most train companies buy units, train carriage units of like 4 carriages or 8 carriages, something like that, which is quite inflexible. Whereas Chiltern bought units of 2 and 3 carriages because you can actually combine that into any combination of length. So you can always make sure the capacity is right for the number of people who want to travel at any particular time. So it's about designing a consumer product that is genuinely competing with the car. That, as you rightly say, doesn't always happen, but that's how we increased revenue from 100 million to 200 million.
Who's doing this really well now? Like, I feel that Chiltern Railways was this amazing story when he were there, and then he left, and clearly it's not gone as further forward as one might have hoped, because you're not there anymore.
That's the only reason.
Absolutely.
Nothing else to it whatsoever.
These things are only good when Thomas works there. But where do you look to now as that is a thing that you admire, people should be going and spending time, this is where you go on your work holiday and go ride that bus, take that train? Who's doing this really well right now?
So in terms of designing a highly attractive experience, I think Switzerland. And I went to Switzerland twice this year, once for work, once for pleasure. In both cases, it involved traveling on lots of trains, but the work time, it also involves spending a lot of time with the SBB team. Switzerland isn't doing it in the same way Chiltern Railways did, and that's fine. Yes, Chiltern Railways, it was a private business trying to generate demand in order to create a return for shareholders. SBB, it's a public service. And I think we sometimes get a bit tied up with public versus private, and actually both can deliver an outstanding experience if people feel the right incentives. I know we're asking the SBB team, why do you do this incredible work on punctuality? When I was waiting in Basel station to get a train to Bern to meet the SBB team, and I looked up on the screen and my train was 19 minutes late, 1:09. And in Switzerland terms, that's unacceptable. And indeed, a few minutes later, the information screen flicked around, and it now said, on time, Ersatzzug, which means replacement train. And they had literally added in a replacement train into the schedule because 19 minutes is an unacceptable delay. I said, well, why do you do all this? And the answer that the team gave me was pride. That's, for them, the alternative to the Chiltern Railways. We're doing this in order to generate a shareholder return. Both are fantastic. But, you've got really punctual trains, really clean trains. Really smart little details. I was on an SBB train and they'd put some little hopscotch things in the vestibules for kids to be able to play on. Some of the intercity trains have full-scale playgrounds with slides and climbing frames. This is about, again, making it an experience that people actively want to use. In terms of cities, there's a lot of cities that are doing some really exciting work. I think Oslo is really interesting, and it's often easy to say, they would be able to, wouldn't they? Because Oslo's got so much money because they created an incredible sovereign wealth fund out of North Sea oil, which we Brits didn't do. But people can, even if you're wealthy, you don't necessarily spend your money the right way. They've completed decarbonisation. And they've got a really exciting vision for how to integrate autonomous vehicles into the city public transport network. And that's something I'm really hoping to see more of, because there's lots of questions, you know, will autonomous technology work? Will it deliver its promise? You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if it does deliver its technological promise, there's a real danger that it will materialize as robo-taxis and private cars, because it's coming out of the car-centric culture of North America. And Oslo are one of the few transport authorities that says, what is the role for autonomous technology in a city? The public transport network needs to collectively provide the same level of, the same experience as a private car. And that experience is about freedom. It's about being able to step out of your house and go anywhere instantly. How does the public transport network replicate that? And what role can autonomous technology play in filling the gap? And not many people have that clarity that the purpose of public transport is to provide the equivalent level of freedom and doing the thinking about how autonomous technology can fill in the gap. So I think probably Switzerland and Oslo are the two places that are exciting me most at the moment.
A couple of things for me. So like, there's the whole sort of like pride in how you run a service. There's the reframing what the service can really be. And then there's how you amplify that with the technology on the top. I want to go to the Oslo thing first, because I remember like going to Oslo 12, 13 years ago now. And one of the things that was like listed of the stuff to do in Oslo, because it's not the most touristy of cities, to be honest. But it was like, if you're there in the winter, get the bus up to the Olympic Park and you can rent a toboggan. You ride a toboggan down one of the world's original bobsled tracks. You get to the bottom, you take the toboggan back on the bus that goes every 15 minutes, go back up to the top and you take the toboggan for free. It just, like, to me, like, that, it's a silly little trivial example, but you talk about, like, the freedom point of it. And everybody in North America will say a car is freedom. Whereas I actually think a lot of people in most European cities would say not needing to own a car is freedom. If you want a car, you can still own a car. If you want to, like, do a car thing, you can still use a car share. People will drive to a lot of places. But the freedom is being able to go do the things that you love or being able to go about your day-to-day without necessarily having to own a car. I think it's amazing. If you add on like autonomous technology onto that, I think we're so obsessed with Elon Musk's Tesla robo-taxi, which I don't really get it because it just looks like a car that you can't fit a lot of stuff in. Whereas to me, isn't a taxi meant to be a big thing you can fit a lot of people and things into? This idea of reframing what autonomous transportation is, I think there's a huge opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, I have not done an awful lot of work in this. So this is a very high level estimate. But, you know, at a high level, let's say we can deliver public transport for £1 a mile with autonomous technology. Electric vehicle, driverless, small, but not tiny. Not one of these ridiculous little shuttle things that you see doing at 12 miles an hour around various places. Yeah, a proper vehicle. Low density suburbs at £1 a mile can be connected and can be connected with frequency. And you know, it's frequency that delivers that freedom. You step out of your house, public transport will be along within the next 10 minutes, you use it. Public transport will be along in the next hour, you don't use it. You use your car. You get in a queue of other people using their cars. Now no one's got freedom. Autonomous technology at £1 a mile means you can suddenly connect, not everywhere, but something coming extraordinarily close to everywhere. And you don't need level 5 autonomy. You don't even need perfect autonomy, because public transport is used to control centers. It's used to people supervising services. So you can have a vehicle that says, okay, I only need to be able to operate autonomously within this defined set of boundaries, like a, you know, equivalent to a bus route. And I'll have absolutely amazing, perfect mapping. And I will have someone supervising a set of these vehicles. And I'll be able to intervene via video link if it gets into trouble. And I've already made sure that it's got the 5G always on connectivity within that defined operating area. And suddenly, you've got the reverse of the beaching cuts. You know, in the UK, we closed a third of our rail network in the 1960s. And of course, what suddenly everyone realized was, oh, damn it, we shouldn't have done that, because those very small routes feed the bigger ones. And so the economics of the bigger ones are now looking ropier. Damn it, we've kind of created a vicious circle. That was a mistake, wasn't it? And you get the opposite of that here. You know, if we can connect low-density suburbs into the core public transport network, it doesn't just mean that those places are connected, but it then means the core network becomes stronger. And that then means you can provide more service, more connectivity, which, and you get a virtuous circle starting up. Now, we've not had a new technology that could achieve a virtuous circle in public transport electrification. I know it's a very, very long time, but we might be on the cusp of one, but we're letting Elon Musk own the narrative around it. That seems a shame.
If you look at autonomous, like we've had autonomous for a long time, but the DLR is probably like the best example of that. But like autonomous on rails feels very natural, kind of old. We're not really worried about this thing moving itself. Americans see it with monorails and people movers in mostly in airports. They do an amazing job at that because they don't want to walk anywhere. But there's something about this divide between a piece of mobility that is on rails and a piece of mobility that is on the road. Partly because if there's a bus or a train, a bus or a tram is an example. I think Edinburgh is an amazing example of this. Edinburgh built their tram that went from the city centre to the airport. And everybody started using the tram to get to the airport, even though the airport bus in Edinburgh was probably the world's best airport bus service. Nice vehicle, comfy seat, but people psychologically like the promise of when a vehicle is on rails. If you'd have that in the autonomous world, obviously the road is a far more complicated place to be. But for some reason, the autonomous bus doesn't feel sexy. Like it's something around like, it doesn't feel desirable to be on an autonomous bus, but you'd be very comfortable being on a
Well, indeed, the first autonomous train, you know, actually, you go before the DLR, was in Walthamstow again. Walthamstow keeps coming up. I'm now struggling here. 1969. Anyway, when the Victoria Line opened, it initially just opened from Walthamstow to Highbury Islington. So the first autonomous train anywhere on Earth was in Walthamstow. And I'll see if I can come up with a third reason why we should refer to Walthamstow later on in this discussion. I think that's absolutely right. There's a number of reasons why trams work better than buses in an awful lot of environments. So in fact, they cost an awful lot more. One of the absolute biggest is that just sense of permanence. This is real. Someone's invested money in this. I remember talking to my marketing director at my startup, who kind of said one of the theories of advertising is it doesn't really matter what the advert is. Just the fact that a company is able to spend millions of pounds on advertising gives you a sense this is a company that's making money. It's got permanence. Therefore, you can trust it with your money. And it's a bit like that. Just the fact that someone's put the metal rails in the road, even if the tram then follows what was a bus route, gives you a sense, okay, this is real now, I can trust it. And I think that's absolutely right. The huge advantage of autonomous bus compared to a manually driven bus is the fact that it can go someplace. Because we have a London bus network, and if you're in zones roughly, in London we have concentric circle rings of zones. If you're in zones 1, 2, 3, 4, you have really high-frequency buses that are usable and used by everyone. And within, you know, inner London, which is a defined area, most London boroughs in inner London, the majority of people do not own a car. As soon as you get out of that area, the bus network reduces, and it's still, by global standard, phenomenal. You know, TfL standard is that everyone will be within 400 metres of a bus stop. And a bus stop typically means a frequency of, you know, 12 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. So by global standards, great. But not of the level that someone's going to give up their private car for. Whereas you drive it past the house every 5 minutes and they'll be on it.
There's something about like, you've seen that Chinese tram that's basically
bus. The trackless tram.
The trackless tram. Just something like that. It's a bus, effectively. But I feel like that gets people really excited about this sort of partly autonomous future, but partly also higher quality. Just feels like it, like a bit more cared for. And if we can get to that place where, because the biggest inhibitor to transportation, especially in the bus industry, from what I understand, is it's fuel costs and labor costs. And if you take much of the labor cost out and we've already gone electric, then you should be laughing.
But yeah, we haven't. Couldn't agree more. And I think one of the challenges is that, yeah, you know, politicians worry that there's a narrative around AI, around jobs, autonomous vehicles, autonomous buses, bus drivers losing their jobs. I'm the mayor, I'm putting them out of a job. And suddenly that whole conversation goes sour. And I don't think that's the conversation we're having. I don't think that the big red London buses that you see on the postcards are going to run without drivers anytime soon, even if the technology allows them to. As you mentioned earlier, the DLR has been automatic since 1987, the Victoria Line since the 1960s, both of them still are fully staffed 100% of the time. Because if you've got that number of customers in one place, you need a human being to look after them, to check the doors, to check safety, etc. And that'll be the case for the big red London buses. So basically anything that's got a driver now will probably have a driver forever. The really interesting question is the places that we're not currently able to connect to the public transport network, can we connect them with something that is autonomous? And again, it's not about perfect autonomy. It doesn't need to be. It's about creating something that within a zone to a level is able to provide a service at significantly lower cost than anything we've got at the moment.
It's one of the, you talked about in Oslo, they've obviously got a lot of money from because they use their oil well sensibly. It's one of the biggest challenges actually just the finance of these things, because it almost feels like, I don't think we really appreciate how much a road network is really subsidized. So in Canada, people will tell you that the gas tax is how you pay for roads, but like cents on each liter of fuel, it doesn't go anywhere near towards actually building and maintaining roads, but people think it does. And then when you see a transportation project getting built, people see that as, oh, that's extortion. That's ludicrous for spending that money on something. Is a challenge really just reframing actually where does the money go and here's why the money is worth it? That,
yeah.
The Norwegians don't really have to worry about.
The number one subsidy for cars that everyone determinedly misses is a parking space. Yeah, this is state-owned land that we provide for free to private citizens for their personal use. And no wonder, we don't do that in any other circumstance. If I go to the government and say, actually, I'd like a bigger garden, so I'd like you to provide me a patch of land about the size of a Land Rover Discovery so that I can grow vegetables, they will tell me where to stick it. But if I want to park a Land Rover Discovery outside my house, then depending on where you live, it'll be free or a nominal charge. It's literally unique. I mean, we don't provide water for free. We don't provide food for free. The things that you need to live are paid for. The only thing that the government provides for free for its citizens are, in the United Kingdom, healthcare. Amazing. Very glad I live here. Schools and road space. And for some reason, most people are aware of the first ones, but they're not aware of the last. But you're right, funding is crucial. And the countries that do this well are typically those that have nailed this, which is something that Britain hasn't. In its kind of vaguely chaotic way, Britain kind of staggers from funding model to funding model, but somehow keeps paying for stuff. But again, one of the reasons why Switzerland is able to excel in public transport is because this is done really intelligently. So they have a infrastructure fund. The infrastructure fund is formed of a dedicated pool of hypothecated taxes. So automatically, these particular taxes flow into the transport infrastructure fund. Because these taxes are very stable, you can predict with a very strong degree of accuracy how much is going to be available to spend every year for the foreseeable future. The infrastructure fund is then divided into two pots, one for enhancements, one for renewals. So every year, they are obliged to put in capital investment on new stuff, and they are obliged to maintain the stuff they've already got, which is a great way of doing this. And actually, why can't we just do that? It works in Switzerland. You can go and see the quality of the outcomes. And then because they've got the ability to think for the long term, they're then able to make the intelligent long-term investments. So, you know, for example, if you walk around a Swiss railway station, it all looks and feels like an SBB station. The signage is SBB, the infamous, famous, amazing SBB clocks everywhere. But actually, the station is divided down the middle. And a very large chunk of it is owned by SBB's property development company. And they then make very substantial property investments in order to generate a profit stream to fund the rest of the transport network and to make their stations a really high quality environment. But they can do that because they know what their long-term funding capabilities are going to be.
I think it's the, when I was doing stuff around stations, you'd always get the cliched thing of people talk about Hong Kong and in Japan of, the Hong Kong was always the common one, but like
yeah,
the MTR is a property yeah. developer that just happens to have a railway connecting its buildings. But it's kind of an important point, and it actually means that you have the pride of running the service. I suspect the pride comes later. It's actually having the money to run the service that's public, then the money to run the service that is very commercial. And then because you've set that up, you're very proud of that. And then you're continuously thinking about how you layer on top and do more. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is all down to money. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. It is all down to money. And if you look at, you know, France, for example, you've got the Versement Transport, which is this, you know, again, hypothecated tax in which, you know, every business it has some money put on its payroll to fund urban transport. And so you've got unbelievably high quality, you know, tram networks sprouting all around France, high frequency, that sense of freedom. Whereas if you look at the regional transport network, it's bloody awful in France. You know, everyone thinks that French trains are great because they've been on the TGV. You try getting a rural train in France, you'll find out there's two in the morning and two in the evening to and from the local market town. If you get into town and finish your shopping at midday, well, luckily they've got some good cafes in France because you've got 4 hours to wait for the next train. And that's, yeah, that's because of the way the funding structures are designed. Better transport, the funding needs to be there. But it can pay for itself. And one of the things I find really interesting is looking at the United Kingdom, because you kind of run the natural experiment here, because London Transport was set up in the 1990s. And since then, London has operated a completely separate funding and delivery model to the rest of the United Kingdom. And has outcomes, therefore, have diverged wildly. And London now has this really high quality, high frequency, dense public transport network. There's almost no other transit networks in the UK. There's a tiny, tiny Newcastle, Glasgow, Liverpool have really small networks. There's no tram lines survived the cull of the 90s, but a few have been built back. But it's really sparse. And if you look at the productivity levels, basically the productivity map of the UK is the tube map. London has the highest productivity in the UK and massively above European average, equivalent to places like Paris and Frankfurt. But actually, even within London, places like Sutton and Bexley that aren't on the underground have below average productivity. And then the rest of the United Kingdom, almost every other major city in the United Kingdom, productivity levels are equivalent to Eastern Europe. So we can see that investments in transport, yeah, you've got to get the funding model right, but the West is suffering a productivity crisis. You know, the whole of Europe, including the United Kingdom, most of America, take out Silicon Valley. And we kind of know the answer because we've run the experiment here in the UK. Glad to be of service, guys.
There's a thing around people, I always get criticism for this when I've been looking at Toronto. They're like, oh yeah, but we're not London, we're not Paris, we're not Amsterdam. And I've never said we are or should be. But you can look at those places and kind of learn from them. There's a really interesting thing in the UK is like, Manchester is an example of they want to move to be more like TFGM wants to be like TfL, but Manchester isn't like London. And the context of what's been built is different. The density is different. The car ownership usage is different. The network isn't as good. But I worry there's this that we need to copy them. But actually, like, do we have the money to copy them? There's this challenge of like, how do you learn but don't necessarily go and like apply a model that doesn't work to where you are?
I agree with that. I worry slightly that the way that the narrative in the United Kingdom has developed, it's we want to be like London. Therefore, to get to that point, we need to do what London's done. London has evolved to this point over 100 years, nearly, of London Transport existing. 1933, London Transport came into existence. And it's got a highly bespoke system designed around the needs of the world's first megacity. And there's things you'd do differently if you were starting again, but ultimately it's very good, but it's designed around London. What are Manchester's needs? What are Liverpool's needs? What are Sheffield's needs? They're not going to be the same as London's. Manchester's lifting and shifting a lot of the London model. The London bus model has been pretty much replicated. They're introducing a bike scheme heavily based on London. They're introducing a payment system based on London. Now, actually, is, for example, a contactless-based payment system the right solution? London's got it. It'll be great in Manchester. People will love it. On the other hand, look at Switzerland as an alternative. In Switzerland, you've got a system whereby you literally can just run an app on your phone. As you travel around, it's monitoring where you're, the geolocation of your phone, see where you are, and automatically direct the right fare for the day or the week for all of the journeys you've made. And you literally have got to do nothing. You don't have to touch in on the individual journeys you make. It just monitors you. So actually, maybe the Swiss model, it would be better if you're starting again, because in London, you can't do that because we put gates in, and we put gates in long before contactless payment existed. So, you know, I think, yeah, it'd be inspired by different cities. And there are some incredible cities in Europe to be inspired by. But what's the city model and environment that you're trying to create?
And then how do you pay for it? Because like TfL's not cheap. There's a huge amount of money that goes into that. Like, and Manchester's not as big. The idea is just like, I'll copy their governance model and it'll work. It just doesn't really feel like it stacks up. Again, we come back to the, how do you fund these things?
And one of the things that, yeah, this is where a lot of people start shouting at me and telling me I'm wrong, but one of the things that I'm not massively fan of, a massive fan of, is actually this whole narrative that's emerging in different places around low fares or no fares. You know, Luxembourg abolished public transport fares. It's entirely free within Luxembourg. Now, Luxembourg's not a big country, that's putting it mildly, but it is still a country. It's got, you know, cities and towns and villages and all those things. And that public transport's free. I don't want public transport to be free. And I'm, yeah, I don't work for Transport for London anymore. So they took away my pass. So I've got to pay. I'm like everyone else. So it would benefit me personally if public transport was free. But I don't want it to be free. One, because of the Chiltern Railways conversation we had earlier, actually, it's a business. And it's much better if it acts like a business and attracts customers. And it where people choose to use public transport as opposed to spending their money somewhere else. Two, it's a revenue stream. And pockets of passengers is a great way of generating revenue. Thirdly, actually, because I don't think it's a massively efficient way of achieving social goals. You know, one of the London bus network is now roughly £1 billion worth of subsidy, largely because a very, very substantial proportion of people who use the bus don't pay. And my daughter's one of them, because my daughter's disabled, so she gets a free pass, and we appreciate it hugely. My mum doesn't pay because she's elderly, so she gets a free pass. Great, but a more efficient way of achieving social outcomes is through the tax and benefit system. And then it's targeted at precisely the people who need it. Whereas trying to use the public transport system to achieve social goals means that the cost of the public transport system is artificially inflated. It now says that's £1 billion worth of subsidy there. Well, not really. What's actually happening is we're boosting the incomes of certain social groups who we feel need it. I'd rather we just gave them the money and the public transport system can earn its keep.
There's also the thing of, if you make it free, you're always then going to be like looking to, how do I cut costs to serve this more cheaply?
Absolutely.
And the service will get worse and then people will use it less.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you, like, it doesn't have to, I always find it interesting of like this places where, I think Toronto is a good example of this. Toronto, more money comes into the Transit Commission from fares than most other places. Most places, that the actual fare you're paying isn't paying for the full cost of the transport system. But at least, like, it's a way of managing demand, or you can go, how do we smooth this demand so that not everyone's getting the 9 o'clock train when a lot of people can get the 10 o'clock train, for instance. And I think, like, that's the... Transport shouldn't be expensive, but I think there's still a sort of cost to a journey that feels fair.
Yeah. And yeah, the best way to make transport not expensive, given that it's a collective system, is to get more people using it. If more people are using it, it won't be expensive organically. The biggest obstacle here is people driving their own cars, which takes us right back to the start of, how do you create a city environment in which people don't want to drive their cars?
How do you get over this problem? Because I think it's a really interesting marketing challenge, effectively, of how do you make transportation so good that you would feel dumb taking your car? And there's instances of that where it's I would never, even if Euston Station is awful, I would still rather get the train from London to Manchester, because driving on the M6 is terrible. That's one thing. But then there's also the going to the shops. Like, how do you stop people from driving their car into a city centre to go shopping in the Arndale Centre versus taking the tram, taking the bus, riding a bike, whatever? And I think that that's the thing to get over, because if you get to that point, for a politician to stand up and say, I'm going to do a thing that is financially punitive on a car owner, people are like, that's okay, mate, because the bus is nice.
I think you literally just said it. You make the transport network so good that you'd feel stupid doing anything else. And again, I'm going to do it. In Walthamstow, we get the Victoria Line into central London. And no one is making a policy decision there. And it's not controversial. Everyone gets the Victoria Line. Some people cycle. Because obviously, you know, it runs every 2 minutes and it takes 20 minutes. So why would you do anything else? And it's just not a question. For as long as, if you're in the question, you know, people talk a lot about carrots and sticks. And I always worry about the language of carrots and sticks. It feels like you want an environment where the decision architecture is so simple and so obvious and so intuitive that of course you're going to make the decisions that are sustainable and best for the city environment. And the fact that then, yeah, there's a congestion charge in central London, so actually if you do drive into central London, you'll pay a chunk of money. Well, no one is not driving into central London because of the congestion charge, because they're just getting the Victoria line, because it's the obvious thing to do. And before anyone writes in, yes, of course, some people are driving because they need to and all that. I get that. But overwhelmingly, journeys from Walthamstow to London are made by public transport. And that environment is just intuitive.
So I want to come back to, you talked about Swiss trains, and they have like hopscotch things on the train, or they'll have like different kinds of layouts. And I'm really fascinated by actually challenging the conventions of what a train or what a bus is. Because if you look at a train today, broadly speaking, or a bus today, it's the same thing that they were 100 years ago, but with probably slightly comfier seats. They're not wood. They're now some sort of muckat that doesn't look too dirty, or they're plastic that you can wipe down. But beyond that, we haven't, and the mode of propulsion might have changed, but we haven't necessarily changed. Like, actually, how do you, what does this thing look like? What do you do on a train other than sit, look at your phone, look out the window? What do you do on a bus? Do you think there's any, is this a neat thing where I'm like a weirdo thinking about, like, how do we change this? Or is there actually any impetus in the industry to go, how do we challenge the conventions of what we really are?
Let's be honest with you. The trains are not more comfortable than they used to be. They're less comfortable than they used to be. Have you ever been to the Isle of Man?
Not for a very long time.
It's an extraordinary place because they still run the original Victorian transport network. It's public sector. They have a bus network, which is run by the same Isle of Man Transport, uses modern buses just like any other. But then you've got the extraordinary railways that just have never been modernized. It's bonkers. And the steam railway uses the same carriage that they opened with 150 years ago, exactly the same carriages, untouched. They're still running them. You touch in with a smart card and then get onto a 150-year-old carriage with a compartment that is vastly more comfortable than anything you'll travel on anywhere else, which is pretty embarrassing, quite frankly. So what you're saying here is, it's the source of my secret shame, and it made me realize actually how institutionalized as a transport person I am. And I find this story really embarrassing, but I'll tell it because it was an insightful moment in my own development. When I was at Chiltern Railways, I was responsible as commercial director, so I was responsible for the revenue line. So I was therefore responsible for the design of our customer proposition. And we built a new railway from Oxford to London, which involved building two new railway stations. And one of those stations was at Bicester Village, which is a retail outlet. It's the most, I don't know if it's still true, it certainly was when I was at Chiltern Railways. It has the highest revenue per square meter of any shopping centre in the United Kingdom. Chinese tourists come over in their droves and spend thousands of pounds on stuff there. And then go and see where Harry Potter lived. And I've spent a lot of time in Bicester Village because we built a railway station there. I have so far never bought anything other than a Pret coffee in Bicester Village. They're probably their worst single customer. And so I was responsible for the design of the station, and I put a lot of effort into it. I think if you go to Bicester Village or Oxford Parkway railway stations, I think we designed some really nice, attractive stations. I was proud of them. However, we also gave Bicester Village a plot of land to build their station entrance on their site, and we put the railway boundary down the back of the platform and said, look, we didn't give them a plot of land, it was their land. We said, look, we'll open a hole in the fence here, and you basically build a station building that opens directly onto the platform, and here are the ticket gates you need to put into it, here are the ticket machines you need to put into it, you know, here's what you need to do to make it work, but it's your land, you build a station directly into the shopping centre. And they did. So I, on the day that this railway was about to open, I went and looked at our station building. It's, yeah, this looks great. This is specified to my designs. I'm really satisfied with this lovely building. And then I went down to their station building, walked in, I was like, oh my Lord. And it was like walking into a 5-star hotel. I mean, it was beautiful. You know, there were sofas, there were little lamps, there were little desks and the places where you could work. It was just beautiful. Google it. And in the midst of it all, our hideous, you know, ticket machine and ticket barrier. And I just thought, oh my Lord, I'd never imagined a railway station could look like this. And it was only did look like this because it was designed by retail people in a high-end shopping centre. And I just, yeah, I realised that I'm so constrained by what it can be. It's one of the reasons I actually quite like these ludicrous luxury trains that are now running. I'll give you a little quiz question here. So what's the most expensive train fare in Europe?
I mean, I would assume it's the Orient Express, but...
Okay, good answer. What's the most expensive fare you can pay for a single, you know, one journey on the Orient Express? Make a guess.
40 grand.
78,000. I mean, it's obviously mental. They've basically gutted one of the carriages and turned the entire carriage into a single compartment with your own private dining room, ensuite bedroom. You literally get basically a kind of massive hotel suite of rooms pretending to be a 1920s railway carriage. It's mad. It's bonkers. But I actually also rather like the fact that they're completely reimagining what a train experience can be. And obviously, you and I will never travel on it. Well, you might. You and I will never travel on it. But at least that thinking is taking place somewhere. How else can we reimagine what it looks like?
I'm sure the Orient Express might be listening to this and they might go, oh, these guys are thinking how to reimagine transportation in cities. Let's comp them a trip on it and they can be inspired by the amazing thing that we've made.
You're right. That's what they will be thinking, isn't it?
Absolutely. 100%.
Of course.
Or a client will be thinking, hang on, we need these guys to understand what they've done and they'll pay for us to do it. I'm good either way.
Yeah. I can't quite see how we can do any legitimate work for anyone without that level of insight, quite frankly.
I remember flying with Lufthansa a few years ago and got on a plane and I was like, didn't really think much of Lufthansa. Had a basic economy ticket, had a middle seat. I was like, oh, this is going to suck. And then someone came up to me and went, Mr. Montgomery, can I give you an upgrade? And like, yes. And they upgraded me not to premium, not to business, but to first. And you had this beautiful like space. And it's like, it's not like the sort of Middle Eastern airlines, but like you just looked at it and went, everything that you've done in this little pod has been perfectly thought through, apart from the fact you've upgraded the wrong passenger. But like, I just don't get how we can't bring those things into it of like, how do you just put those little touches in? And like car manufacturers have done it so well in certain places, but like not in others. Like just bring that into transit and we'd all be happier and healthier and more prosperous and productive. It'd be amazing. But
my first boss used to call it atoms of delight. And he was the director of strategy at National Express. And he was really big on this idea. And it was great. Because again, he'd joined from the consumer goods company that I can never pronounce, Reckitt. That's him. And, you know, he just came in with a different mindset to the traditional public transport people in National Express who kind of looked at him slightly sort of, why would we want to do that? But I actually learned a lot from him because, he was my first boss in transport and he approached the whole thing from a consumer perspective. A lot of people don't.
How to make the buses that come out of that bus depot nicer. And I feel like we get a bit snooty around like they work for a consumer goods company, they don't understand us. And we're like getting over that's so important.
This is, to be fair though, true of every profession. I did a LinkedIn post recently about the curriculum and my daughter's experience of the curriculum and the number of people who told me I had no right to comment on the school curriculum because I wasn't an educationalist. And I was like, well, I'm not, I'm a parent. And I would never say to a transport customer, you have no right to comment on the transport network because you're only a user of it. I think it's everyone always thinks I've developed some professional expertise and now I'm going to hoard it and not let anyone else in upon it.
So I want to ask you two more questions. One is more like plug freewheeling a little bit because I'm really curious about you now being in this independent position and bringing your expertise of being an operator on the big and small and private and public side of it and how that's working. And I also then want to, I'll prime you, but I'll come back and ask you, like, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to make transportation amazing so cities can be better challengers? We'll go to tell us a bit about freewheeling there.
Yeah, sure. So there's two things I'm focused on. One is a specific thing, which is trying to help organizations become that bit more entrepreneurial and learn some of the lessons from entrepreneurial organizations, because I've had this rather privileged career of being able to alternate corporate and highly entrepreneurial businesses. And I saw just how fast we were able to get things done at Shilton Railways and how much we were able to do in a short period of time. And then, of course, I joined a startup and took money from various venture capitalists and worked in a venture capital portfolio alongside other startups. And so I've seen in detail how those organizations work. And then bookended that with a career in National Express and Transport for London. So I get how traditional corporate works. And what I realized is, A, very few people switch between the two. There's not many startup people who go into corporate transport. There's not many corporate transport people who go into startups. But actually, there are lessons and approaches and ways of working from startup land that can work in corporate transport. And they, if we adopt some of those approaches, we would get things done faster, we'd be more agile, and we'd be able to deliver outcomes for our users and potentially, if you're a transport authority, voters, more quickly. So helping organizations with that is the first thing. And the second thing is a lot of the stuff we've been talking about today around, you know, supporting anyone who wants support with some of the things I've learned about how to make transport work over the last 20 years. And it's freewheeling, and it's freewheeling.info. And there's a podcast and a blog, which I really enjoy talking to people. So it's like, well, if I'm going to spend my time having interesting conversations, I might as well record them. So the podcast happens every week. And then also I think best when I write down my thoughts. So I have a weekly blog as well.
Perfect. I'll put it in the show notes. So I want to come to, let's get away from the realism, but if you had like a magic wand and you could apply it to something relevant to transportation, what would your priorities or wish command
be? Oh, undoubtedly, it would be politicians' brains, and it would be to eliminate the fear, because Walthamstow, you know, as well as fourth reference now, as well as all the other things we've talked about, we have, you know, the whole of Walthamstow has been reimagined around walking and cycling. You know, the low traffic neighbourhood universally, you know, modal filters everywhere, streets pedestrianised. It's a wonderful place to live. The guy who introduced that had to fight all kinds of opposition, and as a result, he was re-elected with an increased majority. All around the world, people who just do this stuff win elections. Ken Livingstone, after the congestion charge, was re-elected. The fear comes from the fact that, like so many changes, during the period in which the change is being talked about but hasn't yet been seen, people haven't realised the benefits of it, the minority of people who don't like it are very vocal. And this happens with a whole load of things. But then certain iconic events have taken place. So in the UK, for example, we had a by-election. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. There's a guy called Boris Johnson who used to be Prime Minister of this country. You've got him. He was kicked out of Parliament for lying. And so there had to be a by-election. The by-election took place just a couple of weeks before London introduced his ultra-low emission zone, which is a payment charge for if you're driving a high-polluting vehicle. So the worst possible moment for this by-election to happen, because people were talking about it and were fearful of it and it was angry about it, but no one had yet seen the benefits of it. It hadn't happened and been bedded in. And so the Labour Party, you know, Sadiq Khan's party, he's the Mayor of London, who was introducing it, lost that by-election and immediately restarted this whole fear thing. Haddenham and Thame Parkway station, you mentioned earlier, is your local station. If you ever parked in Haddenham and Thame station car park or walked through Haddenham and Thame station car park, I opened that car park and I got the guy to open it. It was a guy called Peter Roberts, who was the founder of the Drivers Alliance. He had previously poisoned the well of transport policy for a generation by being the first person to get over 1 million signatures on the Downing Street Petitions website opposing a road pricing scheme. And again, it was just pure timing. It happened to be that the Petitions website had just been started. Therefore, someone had to be the first to get the 1 million, and it was him. But these iconic moments have taken place that have created a real sense that this stuff is politically toxic. And what's lost is the fact that politicians who do this stuff actually go on to win elections time after time after time.
Yeah, and Hidalgo, Paris, Valerie Plan, Montreal, like they all do it. So there's an interesting thing. I'm like, we've gone too long, but there's an interesting thing of like female politicians tend to be a bit braver with these things, especially when they're mayors. But like, I've got no scientific evidence to back that up. It's just something kind of interesting there. But yeah,
certainly Hidalgo is a great example of that.
One more question, because this is really important, because you're basically the unofficial head of the tourist board for Walthamstow. So anyone who listens to this and then goes, I'm going to go to Walthamstow, where should they go for a beer or a coffee or a meal? Because you plug so much, we may as well do one more Walthamstow.
Okay, so I would go for a beer in my local, obviously, which is the Castle on Grosvenor Rise East. I would go for a coffee in the church. We have an absolutely beautiful medieval church, 13th century, 12th century, I'm not sure exactly. It was the oldest building in Waltham, so it's absolutely stunning. And the vicar very sensibly recently decided to turn it into a coffee bar during the time that it's not being used for services, with a really high quality local coffee place setting up in there. So it's a incredibly lovely place to be. What was the third one? A meal. Sourdough pizza. Sourdough pizzas on a muse, which I think the transport link here is, I think it's the old stables for the horse tram network. I think it is. Either way, I told people that what it was because that was where my startup was based, in one of the old stables in Hatherley Mews. And so I felt there was a transport link there, and someone told me that's true, but I'm not entirely sure it is.
Let's not worry about the truth getting in the way of a good story though.
Yeah, that's fine. In that case, it's in the old horse stables for the old tram network. Hatherley Mews, Sourdough Pizza.
Thomas, you've been a joy to talk to. I could go on and on, but like, the people might make it through an hour. They might not want to listen to us for two. It's been so fantastic. I'll put like connections to Freewheeling and you on LinkedIn. She writes some fantastic stuff, but this was great.
Really enjoyed it myself. So thank you so much for asking me. It's been great fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening to another one of these hour-ish long episodes all about trying to help make cities become the challengers. Before you go, I do need a little bit of help. So I want to get this thing to get out there in the world, get a bit of traction. So do like, share, review it, send it to a friend, plug it on LinkedIn, Twitter, Blue Sky, whichever your social media poison is. Because I hope you've enjoyed listening to it because you got to this far. And if you're listening to me now, I probably think you did enjoy it. So yes, let's take this thing bigger, broader, further, wider. And once again, thank you for listening. And I'll see you on another episode very, very soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.